Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 45, where we are discussing Fred Alford's Whistleblowers, Broken Lives, and Organizational Power. Get the text, and for more information, please contact our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph coming to you from Montana.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle in the United States.
My name is Dimitris, podcasting from Athens in Greece.
This is Pedro coming to you from Lyon in beautiful France in a beautiful sunny day.
And I'm Mariana Faki, and I'm based at Warwick Business School, and I'm now speaking from Warwick with 30 degrees.
Wow.
Well, we have, as Mariana noted, we have a special guest today. Mariana Faki is a professor of business ethics at Warwick Business School. She holds degrees in medicine, health economics, and has a PhD in public policy from the London School of Economics and Political Science. Before joining academia in 2003, she has worked as a medical doctor in Greece, China, and the UK as a volunteer and manager for humanitarian organizations, Médecins du Monde and Médecins Sans Frontières in Iraq and Albania, and as the EU senior resident advisor to governments in transition, including Russia, Georgia, and Armenia. Mariana is at present a senior editor for organization studies and co-directs pro bono an online think tank, Center for Health and Public Interest, a charity that aims to disseminate research informing the public and policymakers. Its website is CHPI, that's Charlie Hotel Papa India, .org.uk. Today we're going to discuss a text selected by Mariana. It was written by Alford in 2001, titled Whistleblowers, Broken Lives and Organizational Power. Before we go into the details of the discussion of the work, I just want to give a high-level overview. There's many articles and research journals and papers and books written about whistleblowers. I think what is particularly interesting about this work by Alford is that he writes from the perspective of what is it that motivates the whistleblower and what happens? What's the experience of the whistleblower? And he uses narrative analysis to truly get into the heart of that deeper understanding. And the research is based on conversations he's had with many whistleblowers. His primary data collection method was finding people who would talk to him, which is not always easy for whistleblowers because it's a very difficult experience, as he recounts in the book. And the ideas in the book are spread across 7 chapters, and essentially they address what motivates the whistleblowers, and Alford develops a theory of moral behavior for that, which I found was particularly interesting. Whistleblower ethics, he calls it. He also talks about the way they actually have difficulty telling their own story and being in touch with their story, and moves on to discussions about the implications for ethical theory, organizational thoughtlessness, which is a very interesting concept. And in the last chapter, talks about political theory, a political theory of sacrifice.
I just only would like to add to this that I've chosen Fred Alford's book for a couple of reasons. First of all, Alford's book differs from the dominant accounts in 2 ways. Well, first of all, people who write about whistleblowers, either researchers or sympathetic journalists, they will most of the time present the story, which reads as follows. You have this exceptional individual who performs courageous acts on behalf of society. She or he goes through many tribulations and trials. And in many cases, you know, the person is vindicated. Of course, we have also some negative accounts of whistleblowers who actually become destroyed through the process. But there is a moral undertone which suggests that these people become destroyed because actually either they are not genuine whistleblowers, or even if they are, they do that. I mean, they speak up basically because of their personality, which is problematic. Now, so we have these two narratives. On the one hand, we have the hero narrative, and on the other hand, we have a narrative, the person who is actually, well, not really a hero, but actually a person who is disloyal to organization, right? And Alford actually offers a very counterintuitive narrative. He says that very few whistleblowers, contrary to popular belief, very few whistleblowers actually are vindicated. Of course, he details in a very chilling way, I have to say, the ways that the whistleblowers are destroyed, but he uses it to theorize the role of individual in organization. And that's kind of unique. So not only does he actually break our optimistic account, but he uses that account for us to learn about the role of an individual in a bigger setting, which is the organization. And of course he rejects the negative, accounts of whistleblowers as narcissists. He actually uses the narcissism in a productive way, to which I will come when we will discuss the specific chapter. So he talks about moralized narcissism, which introduces a level of complexity, very much needed complexity. So I think Alpha, and it's very accessible and very, very honest book, I would say, as well.
Okay, I'd like to start with one question, because it just seems to be kind of central to the book, and that is, how does he define whistleblower? On page 18, he's got a passage which says, in theory, anyone who speaks out in the name of the public good within the organization is a whistleblower. But in practice, the whistleblower is defined by the retaliation he or she receives. How do you respond to that?
Alford starts with the uncontroversial and widely accepted definition of whistleblowing as somebody who speaks up really, in defense of the public interest, I would say. I think Alford problematizes the notion of public interest. He actually says that we really don't have a clear definition of what constitutes public interest. And that's actually, I'm already kind of stealing the thunder. But anyway, I'll just, in a very brief way, I'll say that for Alford, that's a problem. Because we don't have a clear definition of what constitutes public interest, that's why it's so easy to actually reject the whistleblower's disclosure. And of course, to reject the whistleblower herself or himself. Okay, retaliation now. That's also at the heart of whistleblowing, and that's also at the core of how we think about whistleblowers today, because I think that Alford has made a fantastic contribution, but it's, as you said, Ralph, the book has been published in 2001. And while some of the issues that Alford discusses so evocatively are still very relevant, we have actually moved in our thinking about whistleblowing. In fact, we try to address the very issue that Alford brings in, which is the retaliation. So really, I would like to say that associating with whistleblowing necessarily with retaliation already reproduces this duality: somebody who is heroic because she or he has foregone his own well-being, his family's well-being, in order to protect the greater good, and therefore the person suffers, but at the end she or he is vindicated. Now we try to remove that need for a person or an organizational member to have to go through this tribulation, humiliations, loss of a job, loss of health, in fact, financial ruin, and so on and so forth. So we want to decouple the retaliation from the act of being a whistleblower. Okay, still, of course, the majority of whistleblowers suffer retaliation. That's still the case. Yeah, I don't know if I answered your question or if you would like to ask me something more about it.
I thought that was a great discussion, Marianne, of some of the key issues, particularly the one about this, the hero model or role that we sometimes ascribe to the whistleblower. One of the things I was wondering when Tom was asking his question was, if somebody speaks up in an organization and describes some kind of wrongdoing, or and let's, for the sake of argument, describe them as an internal whistleblower. They don't go external to the organization. And the members of the organization say, oh, that's a great idea. And we didn't realize that we were making this error or having this problem. Thank you very much. And they make changes based on that. And such that there is little to no overt retaliation. I mean, you can always imagine some subversive kind of stuff, but not where it ruins a person's life and stuff. Would you consider that, or do you think Alfred would consider that person who does not receive a lot of overt or this
okay,
terribly
so,
cool?
Just reporting wrongdoing without facing the negative consequences of one's speaking up, you know, is not constituting a whistleblowing act for Alfred. I beg to differ, and I'll explain why. Well, let me actually explain how did I come to the whistleblowing, area as my kind of research that I have been involved with other colleagues for the last 5 years. And I'll explain why I beg to differ with Alfred on this point. So we were, my colleague, Professor Kate Kenny from Queen's University and Dr. Wim van der Kerkhove from Greenwich University. We worked for the last 5 years in three projects together. And the projects were founded by the ESRC, Economic and Social Research Council, Liverpool Trust and the British Academy. And initially we started talking, Kate and myself, we are colleagues and friends, and we started talking and asked the question, how come that before the financial crisis broke out, how come that nobody spoke up? And we tried to look at the evidence, and in fact, we found that many, many people did speak up, and unfortunately, in the best case scenario, their advice was not actually listened to. And in the worst case scenario, these people within the banking industry, I'm speaking specifically, were retaliated against. So we then asked the question that Alfred also asks, who is the whistleblower? But as Alfred concludes in this book and in some of his other writings, he says that that's a wrong question to ask, actually. Well, in this book, he actually elaborates on the personality of whistleblower. In his later works, he somehow has softened this approach, right, to actually, describing the certain kind of, faithfulness of whistleblowers to their ideals, their faithfulness to their principles over anything else, right? I will go into that when we discuss the moralized narcissism, which I find very, very interesting. Anyway, so to cut the very long story short, what I'm trying to say is that we started to work with whistleblowers. We asked initially the question, who are these people? And these are people from all walks of life, fact, in various sectors, in various countries. And then we realized that you become a whistleblower after you have spoken up. In fact, your identity as a whistleblower becomes, in a way, retrospectively consolidated, if you allow me for the jargon. So you really become a whistleblower in the process. The majority of people, and I'm returning to your question, I haven't forgotten about the internal versus external whistleblowing. The majority of people actually we spoke to, and this is people from finance, from healthcare, from social services, people who actually were in procurement, people who are in insurance, and so on. So many, many sectors, internal auditors from a variety of countries, US, UK, Switzerland, Ireland, Indonesia. So really many places. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say, and the research seems to converge on this, almost 90%, 90, of whistleblowers try to actually raise concerns internally in the first place. And only when actually their advice is kind of ignored, they go externally. And Alfred doesn't go into that so much. He actually focuses on people who went out, who actually have fallen out with their organization, who went out externally, and he doesn't really too much explain the various stages that people usually go through before going out, before becoming external whistleblowers. So really, Alfred says people who report internally and their advice is addressed, or their complaint is addressed or their concern is being acted upon, they're not whistleblowers. He just focuses on people who actually have to speak up to the audience, to the wider audience, to the public, to the media, or actually to the controlling agency above, which is actually above the organization. Sorry, I think I've just expanded a bit more on that, but I just want to contextualize my difference with Alford, although I obviously admire the book a lot, as I did explain at the beginning.
I just want to kind of slow us down a little bit so that we don't get too far ahead in the book without covering our bases. So essentially, as I see from the book and from what you just said, Mariana, that there is almost like three ways of viewing what or who a whistleblower is, that Alford starts off with this almost consequentialist perspective where you're a whistleblower if you get retaliated against by the organization, and then he almost proposes this more of a like a trait or a personality view with the individualization that we'll talk about, and he speaks of who these people are and how they the conflicts they have with their morality and the worldviews. And then you mentioned that you have a more kind of a processual view on whistleblowing, and that a person becomes a whistleblower through the activity of whistleblowing, I suppose, and that they're constituted as such in the process. Is that, does that sound about right?
That's exactly it. And in fact, and by way of actual advertising, our forthcoming work in organizational studies with Kate Kenny and Wim van der Kerkhoffer, we just write exactly about that, that people really, in many cases, it's their actually contractual obligation to report wrongdoing. So that's why among whistleblowers, say in the banking sector, we have many compliance officers, you know, risk management officers, not only, I'm not saying this is the only case, but in many cases, this is people's contractual duty. In fact, the job is a job description, really. Or we, for example, just to give you another example, one of our informants, and this is Martin Woods. His story is all over in the media. It's like almost like a Hollywood movie. So he is a senior police officer who is hired to the job that has to do specifically with actually detecting, you know, his anti-money laundering officer, with detecting, you know, money laundering, you know. So it's his job to report that. And the problem for Martin becomes when he actually reports on that and he's retaliated against. So I'm not trying to decouple whistleblowing from retaliation. I'm just trying to say that in many cases, whistleblowers, at least in our informants, and we spoke to about almost 100 of whistleblowers, which is a really huge number over the last 5 years, right? And in most cases, we really speak about we actually listen to and speak to people who feel it's their job to actually report on the wrongdoing. So it's a little bit adding a little bit of a different nuance. And they don't see themselves as whistleblowers. You know, they see themselves as performing their duty. So that's kind of an interesting aspect to this, since you mentioned this processual kind of concept of whistleblower identity, Dimitris.
Yeah, and I was thinking that it is at least ostensibly a part of many job descriptions to make sure that there is no that the organization is not failing law in any way, or that resources are not mismanaged or corrupted. And Alford kind of gives some examples of in his variety of stories in the book as well. The one thing that does come through with both the traditional, I suppose, approach to whistleblowing, where it's defined by retaliation, and also in Alford's view, is that there's a strong emphasis on morality. In the case of the former, it's to do with the morality almost of the environment, kind of the normative conditions. And in the case of the latter, of his trait or personality theory, it's to do with the individual morality. And that seems to be a key factor in determining whether something is blowing a whistle or not. Because even the word whistleblowing, it's almost like the old-timey police officers who would, you know, blow a whistle when, you know, to stop a person, or essentially it has this strong notion and import of stopping something that is very wrong, as also was mentioned in the beginning. It's to do with protecting the public from some form of wrongdoing. But in the case of where it's a person's job to essentially blow this proverbial whistle, it seems to lose the morality of it, doesn't it? That if it's your job description to ensure lack of corruption, then where's the whistleblowing?
It's a very, very fantastic question. Thank you very much for this question. All right. So for example, just let me answer that by giving you an example. So a former PhD student of mine, an Indonesian, he was an internal auditor with an experience in you know, in the government of Indonesia, 15 years experience, 1-5, right? And his PhD was founded, in fact, by the World Bank, and the ultimate goal was to help combating corruption in Indonesian public services and the government. And his question was, in his PhD, was as follows. He was, every internal auditor has to detect fraud, right? That's pretty obvious, isn't it? So they were, their job was to audit other government departments, a variety of government departments. And his question was, why, when is the internal auditor acting as a whistleblower? So that was his question. I mean, he defined this question because he observed that internal auditors did their job when actually they were acting upon the implicit or sometimes even explicit order of their superiors. So they would do the proper audit when the client was unimportant and the fraud, unimportant, inverted comma, of course, or the fraud was minute, and they would turn a blind eye when important clients or big issues were involved. And he was actually asking this question, how is it possible, in fact, for an internal auditor to his or her job? So the question of internal morality, so he didn't really frame it in terms of internal morality. He talked more about prosocial behavior, okay? But actually, he examined the question, what makes it possible, in fact, for an internal auditor to do his or her job, in fact? So internal morality may be one way of framing that, and Alford certainly stresses that very, very much. But if I can move forward, and almost 20 years forward, I'm afraid, I have to say, because we are in 2018, because we now realize how important are whistleblowers for detecting fraud, and I'll only give you one piece of information, that 40% of fraud, 40%, 40, actually, is detected by whistleblowers. So this is the single most important a means of detecting fraud. So policymakers realize how important are whistleblowers, and therefore they try to follow two types of measure that Alford does not include in his book. I'm not faulting Alford for that. His focus is different, and I think we should actually discuss more what he really elucidates for us in a unique way, which is still relevant. Probably we can talk about this more later. But anyway, what I'm trying to say, the policy has shifted in terms of actually, on the one hand, not just protecting the whistleblowers, because Alford is quite right in stressing how much legal provision, how many legal provisions we have for protecting whistleblowers and how ineffective these are. And he explains the reasons why these are ineffective. But actually, the policy is now to implement internal speaking up arrangements. So, Dimitris, it is addressing exactly the issue that you mentioned. These are not called whistleblowing procedures. These are called internal speaking up arrangements. So the tendency is to actually change the mentality in the organization that it is a kind of a citizen or citizen organizational citizenship duty to actually raise concerns about wrongdoing. Okay, of course, it's far from perfect. and we can discuss that. But there is a palpable shift. So that's one thing that happens. And the second thing is actually to try to protect the whistleblower. And the U.S. legislation, the Frank Dodd Act, is quite effective in that. I mean, quite effective. It's a big step forward because it actually provides anonymous protection to the whistleblower. And it also meets the whistleblower's cost. It actually gives compensation to whistleblowers, which is proportionate to the money that whistleblower's disclosure would save. Okay, you may say this is more relevant for banking, and this is true, because how can you actually put a sum on disclosure in healthcare, for example? Yeah, I think I'm jumping a little bit ahead I'm moving it a bit forward, I'm afraid, so I should stop here.
This organizational mandate for whistleblowing, though, is fantastic, because that very much ties into later in the book, in chapter 6, when Alfred goes to talk about organizations and the role of organizations in this process. The picture of organizations that he paints is very kind of traditionally unitaristic, but and completely intolerant to dissent and conflict, kind of by and large. But the implementation of these speaking up arrangements that you mentioned is kind of a very good illustration of how we think maybe differently about organizations on one hand, or maybe on the other, how the organizations in Alfred's book are maybe somewhat oversimplified into these Orwellian monoliths.
Well, I really appreciate the way he complexifies the image of the whistleblower, I think the way that the organization is discussed is a bit almost impressionistic, because it's almost like he's talking about social organization much more than formal organizations. So I wonder if that is the problem there. Because as we know, organizations as, you know, places in which people work are much more complex than the way he describes them.
I really enjoyed how he actualized the micro relations in organizations. So instead of negating the bureaucracy and the structure and the hierarchy and all the processes and all the stuff that makes organizations complex, his allusion of relations in the workplace to a feudal system, I thought that was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. And that made me very much kind of think and reflect on my own experiences and opinions, and I'm definitely going to be following up on this. And essentially, just a few words is that Alfred says that despite all the organizational complexities, if you're an individual person in the workplace, you don't work for an office or an organization, you work for your boss, and your boss hires you and determines what you do and when and so on and so forth. Again, it's a bit cartoonish, as Pedro said, but that's kind of his line of argument. And he likens that to the medieval feudal system, where boss is basically a mini lord, and employees are their vassals. And the organization then is this loosely centered kind of a kingdom likeness. And that's very interesting how he imports this organizational model into the modern workplace in order to show why whistleblowers have it the way they do.
May I just comment to that? I think that, it's very evocative the way he writes. And I think, even within our own organization, we can observe traits that Alfred so aptly actually, describes. And he even, page 106, political power wielded as a personal possession. I think this, I'm sure all of you can provide examples that would actually support Alford's view. And the other thing also that he actually says when he talks about, he quotes Jackal, I think, a very influential work by Jackal, when he says, you never go around your boss, You tell your boss what he wants to hear, even when your boss claims that he wants dissenting views, and so on and so forth. And that is a very nice citation from page 102, which actually ties well and chimes with what I said about speaking up arrangements. I don't want by any means to convey, mm-hmm. you know, an over-optimistic rosy picture that internal speaking up arrangements are functioning really well. In fact, that's not the case. All I'm trying to say, and in fact, we have conducted a project, again, in the same team with Professor Kenny and Dr. Van der Kerkhoven. We have conducted a work for the Association of Certified Chartered Accountants, which is in fact available on the website of the Association of Certified Chartered Accountants, again, a joint project with ESRC and ACCA, in which we have actually examined four different types of organizations, one of them being a big bank. We cannot disclose which one it is. The other one being the NHS, we can disclose because it's just only one NHS, right? And then a big engineering global firm, we cannot disclose the name. An Asian, actually, government agency, and I think I've already given you some hints about this. And we try to actually evaluate the existence the absence and existence of internal speaking up arrangements and their effectiveness. And there are certain findings which suggest that we are in very, very early days. And if we want to really make this work, we have to actually do some, and we have to take some specific measures, have them independent, fit for purpose, you know, so this don't become like a lip service. What Jackal says, don't ever tell your boss what he doesn't want to hear, even when she or he claims that he wants dissenting views. In fact, we really want to have these internal speaking up arrangements. We want them to be fit for purpose. What I try to say about Alford just presents, in my view, I wouldn't call it even extreme. He he is very open about it. And I think that's a very big value of his book. He tells us, let us see the organization from a point of view of a person who did his or her duty and was cast away and destroyed. What do we learn about that organization? And that is a very valid point, I think. Even if not all organizations at all points in time conform with Alford's, prediction and depiction, actually it's very important for us to see that from the outside, from the point of view, like he uses this very nice metaphor, I mean, turning the looking glass, you know, and what do we see through that looking glass? And I think that whistleblowers who have been, as he said, I mean, he uses a very nice metaphor, another metaphor that he takes from Daniel Ellsberg, right? You become a skywalker who has been disconnected from the mothership in the space. It's a kind of very evocative thing, like dangling, you know, in the universe, you know. And Alford is really, really very good in just actually getting us into the mind of a whistleblower, what it feels like when everything you have taken for granted no longer holds. No values, no redress in the legal system. You know, your friends, family, even children deserting you. And this is really quite a common story in our empirical research. We found a lot of such experiences. But what is different from Alford's, at least in our experience, is that it's not so absolute. I mean, what Alford seems to be describing is just a Hobbesian world. I know that Hobbesian world is true, but it's it's not as absolute, perhaps, as Alford describes. That would be, I mean, and I'm a great fan of his work, and I hope I'll have more chance to describe why I'm a great fan of his work. But I think really it's very, very kind of, as Pedro said, it's very absolutist in a way. It's not untrue. It's just absolutist, I think.
So, Mariana, I'd like to make a comment about, you were talking about the realization that the whistleblowers have that about things that they are surprised about the way that the world works or what happens to them when they speak up. The author has a really good quote on page 20 where he said, "The greatest shock is what the whistleblower learns about the world as a result, that nothing he or she believed was true." This goes kind of back to that idea of spacewalking you were talking about. They're disconnected from the mothership, and that people can be so deeply shaken by knowledge is not something he expected to find. I think that was a profound insight. This is also on page 20 from his work. You were talking about that. And so the other thing in that chapter about chapter two, titled "Don't Just Do It to Save Lives," I think he has a really interesting insight. You were talking about these insights that Alfred comes up with, which I share your view on that it's that by looking at it from the whistleblower's perspective, you get a different idea of what the world looks like to them. And he has this insight, which I think he took from Hannah Arendt and a few others, where he says, talking about what you're doing means talking about the effects of the acts on other people outside the organization and whether they're good, right, or bad. That's something I thought was really interesting.
So I was drawn into his book for several reasons. One of them is that he asks fundamental questions that are very important. So he asks questions about morality and about ethics. What makes us actually as ethical subjects in organizations, right? What equips us in a way, what gives us capacity to distinguish the right from wrong and act upon this? And this is at the crux of his contribution, I think, because he actually says several times in different, it's a constant, one of the constant messages or refrains even in his book. And this is this, that actually whistleblowers cannot disconnect the consequences that actions have for others. And he says that's a fundamental question of ethics, how our actions affect the others. You know, being able to imagine that and visualize that and being unable, as he calls it, to double down. That is, being unable to disconnect that knowledge from one's own actions. And this leads us, as some of you already have mentioned, to his theorization in chapter 6, when he talks about organizations. He actually concludes that what sets whistleblowers apart from other organizational members who turn a blind eye and therefore become thoughtless, right? What sets whistleblowers apart is that actually ability to visualize and inability to forget that picture, of how our actions affect the others. Probably we can discuss how does that, because in chapter 5 and chapter 4, fascinating, both chapters for me at least, anyway, when he talks about whistleblowers' ethics and consequences of whistleblowers' ethics for society, right? Chapter 4 and 5, respectively. But anyway, this is really quite important. He asks fundamental questions, and that's why he's right in saying that looking at whistleblowers, people who actually share these two capabilities helps us and is very useful in understanding what makes us moral or ethical individuals in organizations and society. I think this is absolutely spot on, and this is a very, very relevant message, actually, and a very important message, and a lasting contribution, I would say, that won't age in a way. I mean, this will always be the question of ethics, I'd say. Well, at least for me, anyway.
And that's all for part one of episode 45. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Fred Alford's Whistleblowers, Broken Lives, and Organizational Power, here on Talking About Organizations.